Well, welcome everybody, and I'm really glad that you've all come. My name's Mary Caldor, and I'm the director of the Center for the Study of Global Governance. And this is one of our events which we do to publicize the yearbook we produce at the center, which is the latest, which is the fourth. It's called Global Civil Society 2004/5. And one of the themes in this year's yearbooks was civil society and democracy. Does civil society hinder or encourage democracy? I mean, it sounds like it's a very obvious issue that democracy is based on civil society. But I think in the last few years, people have asked themselves whether activists have actually got more engaged in single-issue campaigns, NGOs, than in elections. And the result has been a hollowing out of representative democracy. People vote less, people are less involved in political parties, and instead they campaign about peace, the environment, women's issues. And so does that mean actually civil society has been bad for democracy? Well, one of the fascinating things about the last couple of years is that we've seen civil society groups suddenly realizing that elections matter and getting more and more engaged in elections. And we've seen it in America on both sides. We're seeing it at this very moment in Ukraine, and we're very lucky to have someone who's been commenting on, who's been there, who's lives there, and is going to tell us all about the events in Ukraine. And we also saw it in India. Hilary Wainwright, who's here, wrote a chapter on democracy, so she's going to speak, but we're going to start with India, we decided. And we're very lucky to have Jayanti Ravi, who was actually in Gujarat at the time of the riots and is now working for a new civil society group under Sonia Gandhi that's been set up as a result of the elections. And she's going to start.
Yes. I'm making a presentation, so
go over there, that's great.
Good evening, everybody. Am I audible? Can you hear me? First of all, I'd like to thank the Center for the Study of Global Governance for giving me this opportunity. I think it's an honor to be here and to be able to discuss these issues with all of you. I have worked for the government in different capacities, particularly at the district level, and over the last 15 years, we've had many experiences of the way elections have been conducted in India. In fact, I begin this evening's presentation with a small collage that I've put together to give you a flavor of Indian elections. Well, as you see right in the right-hand part of it, these are basically the backbone of election machinery. These are the polling officers and presiding officers who conduct elections across the length and breadth of India. This typically is in the northeastern part of India, where there aren't proper roads. So here you have the polling and presiding officers traveling on elephants to be able to reach their polling booths. To tell you that the diverse geographical locations, you've got snow-clad mountains, arid deserts, islands in the Indian Ocean, and all over these places, elections are carried out in a free and fair manner. The rest of these photographs here, which have been put together, depict the color in elections, the kind of campaigning that happens, posters, and so on. And out here we see people standing in a queue to cast their vote. And I'll quote something that Sir Winston Churchill said many years ago. At the bottom of all tributes paid to democracy is the little man walking into a little booth with a little pencil, making a little cross on a little bit of paper. No amount of rhetoric or voluminous discussion can possibly diminish the overwhelming importance of the point. And here we see a whole lot of little, shall we call them little persons, but that again is a bit of a gender-biased word. Then I thought of humans, but there again there's a man there. So shall we instead settle for a hooper? So we see a whole lot of people here waiting to cast their vote. We see another tall hooper here. She's been someone who's embodied love and service for generations around the world. And this is what happens after the elections. After the elections, you have some candidates who have won, and this is the victory procession. I'd like to relate a small anecdote. While working as a district election officer in the district of Panchmahals, which is headquartered at Godhra, this is about 5 years ago, I remember an election to the local self-governance institution at the lowest level, the village panchayats, as they are called in India, in that particular state, in western India. We found that after the counting process was over, there were all these exit polls which predicted that a certain party which was in power at that point of time which would come back after the elections and would be victorious. But that didn't happen. I remember that as I stepped out of the counting room after all the counting operations were over, we saw the doors, the gates, the trees, the plants all there having this, bearing these festoons of marigold, bright yellow gardens. And for a couple of seconds, I didn't figure out what was the matter. Can anyone guess what could have happened? There were a whole lot of supporters who came with all these garlands to sort of garland the victorious candidates, but their calculations went wrong, and it was an anti-incumbency vote. And there was a completely new set of people who got elected. The point that this incident also tells us that very often it might be a little person or a little hubris, as we discussed, but the effect that it goes to prove beyond a point that, I mean, very, very clearly, that they are very decisive. They demonstrate, the people in India have demonstrated over elections, that they really know what they want. And it has very often surprised a lot of pundits who've been predicting that, well, this is what is going to happen, all the polls and the predictions that have happened. Right at the center of this, you see this another victory celebration, as it were. Now, having spoken of elections in India, which are, as you've seen in the earlier slide, represent the very vibrant, energetic, robust, colorful, and dignified. You see here a description of the election process. It has been given a lot of importance in the sense that it is enshrined in the Constitution, in Part 15 of the Constitution. In fact, India was a country which way back, during the time of Jawaharlal Nehru, went in for universal adult suffrage or voting at a time when 50% of the countries of the world did not have it. The first election was held in 1952. It's come a long way till the recent elections in 2004, where you had an electorate of over 668 million, the largest event of this kind in the world, with about 800,000 polling stations and about 1 million electronic voting machines being used. This was again a historical first in India. And we've had about 4 million staff employed in the process of conduct of elections. Now, the outline of this whole presentation that I plan to make, I wanted to give you a small context, background of what elections in India are like, and then move on to the initiatives that civil society has taken, and then about the impact of these civil society movements. While we may say all this and also mention that they have been free and fair polls, because the results have always shown that predictions have not necessarily come true, the picture isn't quite hunky-dory. I mean, you do have a lot of ills that are there in the system, as some of these strips of cartoons that I've tried to put together may demonstrate. You still have all this happening. And I'll move on to the next slide. There's still a lot of ills of muscle power, money power, criminalization of politics, coupled with governance gaps like lack of accountability, lack of transparency, and there's a general feeling of helplessness that does exist. And this is something, as we were just discussing at the beginning and earlier on with Mary as well, very often NGOs and civil society have gone into niche areas, maybe women and child, or it may have to deal with human rights or specific issues, water conservation, rural development. But you find that at the root of all that is good governance. And therefore, this issue of all these ills being there is something that has made a lot of people think. It has had a lot of people feeling really disturbed about wanting to do something about it. And you've had, it's not that, again, a caveat here is that it's not as if you don't have outstanding people in all spheres, including politics, governance. I mean, this is not to be taken as an overriding factor. You do have these ills, but there are outstanding people of great commitment, integrity as well. But this is a picture that is there. And therefore, civil society groups, which represent the thinking population, very often they have come together to do something about these evils that they found. And we did have a concerted effort by the civil society groups in the recent elections and in the last few elections that we've had. But this is not to say that this movement just started now. If we were to look at the historic elections that were held in 1977, I'm sure a lot of you would be aware of the emergency that happened in India. That was sort of imposed all over India. That was, again, so historically, it's not as if civil society groups got galvanized and came together only in this current recent set of elections that we've been witnessing. This happened even way back in 1977, where you had a leader of the stature of Jayaprakash Narayan, who was able to organize and mobilize student groups, associations, civil society from all over the country way back in 77. And again, they had an agenda of really opposing emergency. That was the main single point agenda. And interestingly, a distinction that I would like to make, this is again something that I view personally, that civil society ought not to get polarized and associate itself with any particular political group. Probably it ought to play a role of being an impartial organization which is able to put facts and issues before the people and let people decide. That is the basic concept of democracy, and that's what was done in that campaign. They did say that emergency was bad, the way it is imposed, all that has happened is bad. But they didn't quite say that, well, we want to come back to power, we want to be ruling. So in that sense, Jayaprakash Narayan was distanced from political power even after the elections. This movement saw the nurturing of a whole lot of NGOs. You might have heard of people like Aruna Roy. She is a person who's been sort of championing the cause of right to information. She was a civil servant in government. So this period, 1977, was the area where a lot of people like this really came into civil society. She quit her job. You also had a lot of politicians of today's time, people like Lalu Prasad Yadav, even Arun Jaitley. They're all a product of this time, Jayaprakash Narayan's movement. But having said that, when there was the incumbent government at that time was thrown and you had a new party come to power, civil society movements all over India were rather disenchanted because the new government that came to power barely lasted for about 2 years, and it was again a big mess that they all found themselves in. So much for that movement that happened then. But nevertheless, I think it's an important milestone. We now move on to the recent civil society movement. This has more to do with the processes of election, and a great deal of emphasis has been laid on transparency, right to information, and fighting the MCP, as in money, criminalization, politicization, nexus. This is something that's really causing havoc, coupled with bureaucratic inefficiencies, political interference in the process of governance. And again, interestingly, this is based on networks, mass contact with people and technology, as well as it's roped in more than 200 NGOs who are really trying to spearhead this campaign. And it has also worked with a lot of coordinated efforts. Civil society has taken the lead. I'll explain how and why and how it happened. But it's not as if they worked in isolation. They've had a lot of support from the judiciary, because I'll talk of 2-3 landmark decisions that happened. You've also had segments within the government which have really proactively worked towards making this happen, media, and most importantly, tremendous support from people. There have been surveys which have shown that people, whether they belong to rural areas or urban areas, whether they were educated or uneducated, Hindus, Muslims, considering that India is a society which has people of different religions staying together, rich and poor, they've all been unanimous in saying that, well, this movement absolutely deserves all our support and we're all with it. This movement started, it's coincidental again today that this is something being discussed in LSE, because the roots of this current movement that we're talking about were sown in the Indian Institute of Management at Ahmedabad. I don't know if many of you are aware of it. It is indeed a world-class institution of management. And particularly, there were two individuals who put this together, two professors out there initially, Professor Trilochan Shastri and Professor Jagdeep Chokar. These were two people, prime movers, who were experiencing the sense of helplessness, but it didn't stop with that. They felt they had to do something. And probably this quote of Margaret Mead is what inspired them. They call themselves the Association for Democratic Reforms. All these ills have been discussed, debated, depicted in TV programs, Bollywood films. You've seen about this nexus of corrupt politicians and how things happen, criminal elements, etc. But they decided to file a PIL, public interest litigation, in the Delhi High Court, praying for certain requests. This, they won the case in November 2000. Immediately, there was an appeal by the Union of India, because government did perhaps feel threatened that this is not something that we should give in to. Now, the Supreme Court reacted very proactively to this and gave a judgment in favor of this group of people who had filed the petition, public interest litigation. After this, the Election Commission of India did implement the order. I will tell you what the order is in the next slide. Again, there was a very surprising and interesting unanimity across all political parties, because when it comes to elections, they're fighting each other tooth and nail, but they were all unanimous in opposing this. They came together. But in spite of it, even the President of India returned the ordinance once without accepting. There was an ordinance which was proposed to say that what the Supreme Court is planning to do is not correct. But then, again, a PIL was moved, and we have the historic judgment of March 2003. What does it say? It made it mandatory that all candidates would have to compulsorily declare their past convictions in any case, criminal case or so on, current cases in which charges have been framed, including those under trial. Very important, considering that you have a large number of candidates with such backgrounds who are in the election fray and also in positions of power. Assets of candidates, till now it was only assets of candidates, but now the court made it mandatory that even the assets of their spouses, children, should be, dependent children, should be made, declared in an affidavit. Their liabilities, thousands of crores of recoverables due from such members of parliament and members of legislative assembly and so on. So this was again a fact that was made compulsory, and their education qualifications. Now, there was a lot of flurry of activity, as you know, initially, to somehow in a quiet and quick manner diffuse this whole thing. However, after this judgment was pronounced, it was perhaps politically correct, and there was no way but for all parties to unanimously accept it, because they had to, you know, say that in the public domain, and they couldn't mince words and say that, well, we don't want this. So they all had to welcome it, and which was welcomed. This historic judgment had many implications. A very important implication of it was the formation of election watches. I'll try and explain quickly what is an election watch committee, what does it do. Basically, these are committees formed by prominent citizens, such as retired judges, civil servants, citizens who are like academics, professors, and also very importantly, NGOs. And this is something that has now happened all over India. You've got election watches constituted across the country. They compile data on all these affidavits that have been filed by individual candidates. It doesn't stop there. Not only do they widely disseminate this data using all forms of media, whether it's print media, electronic media, and so on, but interestingly, based on this data that has been thrown open in the public domain, they also invite public at large to write to them if there is any discrepancy, or if there's anything that has been wrongly declared by the candidates. So they have this concept of a post bag. You take a post bag address and solicit applications from the general public. It doesn't stop there. Based on the applications which are received, they write to the candidates and tell them that, well, these are the allegations we've received with respect to your affidavit, saying that it is faulty on these grounds. And they give them a period of time to respond to it, failing which they go ahead and make public all these complaints that have been received. And this has really worked very well since 2000, and the last elections. The first time it was implemented was in the assembly elections of Gujarat, which were held in November 2002. And we had all these advertisements in a paper. Sometimes the election results may belie some expectations that people may have. But nevertheless, as I maintain, the role of these civil society organizations is not really to push people to vote for a particular party or vote against a particular party, but I think it's more in terms of putting all this information before them and helping them take a decision, considered decision. The next picture shows you some of these election watch campaigns. For example, this is a campaign where Arundhati Roy of The God of Small Things, along with this is Aruna Roy, this is an organization called MKSS in Rajasthan, which is spearheading the cause. And so they are actually walking along five assembly constituencies in Jaipur of Rajasthan. There was a lot of mass contact with people. I'll show you in some of the next slides that follow. In programs like this. This is some kind of a tableau where you have a politician. It's called Ghotala Rath Yatra, a politician who's into all kinds of messing up. You know, he's into all kinds of corrupt practices, and then the people, general public, questioning him. So it's enacted in a role play. Charts with candidate profiles being shown at a public meeting. So what is the percentage of criminal elements that have filed, and so on. So it's all really thrown open in the public domain for people to see. This table that you have here talks of election watches that were held during the recent parliamentary election. In fact, the Election Commission of India, the constitutional authority, has also gone on record to welcome these, and they have, to be very honest, played an extremely proactive role in these. So that's an excellent example of how civil society works in close coordination and in tandem with the authority, which is vested with the powers of conducting a free and fair poll. So you've had, out of the 29 plus 6 states and union territories, you've had about 68.5% of them totally where such election watches were held. And we see that the total number of candidates who were covered also is very large, about 73%. 83% of the constituencies were covered. Findings of election watches, this is again very interesting. You found that candidates with pending criminal cases were about 518. That's about 16.28. This is compiled for all these election watches that were held. Similarly, candidates without PAN, PAN. PAN refers to the permanent account number that an income tax payer has to have. So these are candidates who didn't pay their income tax. So it was things like this that you put in the public domain, and then it's for the public to decide what they want to do, instead of telling them that we'll vote for so-and-so and don't vote for so-and-so. Again, this whole movement, as I said, is not something that one organization has done. And the very raison d'etre of this ADR, Association for Democratic Rights, and such election watches is only and solely election-related democratic process. It's not as if they're into other NGO-related activities and this is an add-on, but they basically exist only for this. This slide has put together, we've tried to put together some of the prominent NGOs involved, like Janadesh and Janagraha are some of them involved in Karnataka. They're like the one of the main NGOs. It's not to say that these are the only ones. You've got more than 200 of them. Incidentally, Be the Change You Want to Be. This is again their line. We've got ADR, Lok Satta. Again, this is an organization which has been formed by someone called Jay Prakash Narayan. He's based in Hyderabad. And they have been specializing in this kind of work. You've got a similar civil society group here in Delhi. This is again the one in Ahmedabad. Now, we quickly move on to the impact of this civil society initiative. We found that although the Supreme Court judgment was aimed only at the parliament and local, the legislative assembly elections, we found that local self-government elections, which are normally held by the state election commissions, which it was not mandated by the Supreme Court that even they should be under this, but nevertheless, they went ahead and completely adopted this, which I think is a very big milestone, a very big achievement. In fact, all the state election commissions have actually committed that even for the local self-government elections, which were not within the ambit of this judgment, they've all decided to sort of accept it and implement it. You've already had this happening in two states, Maharashtra and Uttaranchal, where election watches, filing of affidavits, etc., has been made mandatory. Candidate selection by political parties has also improved tremendously. To give you an example, you found that in Gujarat, in the December 2002 election, you had about 18% of candidates which had a criminal record. But 1 year later, in December 2003, in the four states of Delhi, MP, Chhattisgarh, and Rajasthan, you found that candidates with a criminal background came down to 9%. While there might be a multiplicity of factors, you can't attribute it only to this cause and say it is just because of this that it happened. But I think a lot of us feel that this is one of the important factors that led to this decrease in number of criminal candidates. Similarly, members of parliament and MLAs lined up to clear lakhs of rupees of outstanding dues to the government for rent, electricity, phone bills to avoid embarrassing disclosures in the press, because here they had to give an affidavit. Similarly, you had many such interesting, I think, due to paucity of time, I'll probably rush. Another interesting factor is that the election watch conducted by all these NGOs and civil societies also threw up instances where the affidavits which were declared by the candidates were faulty. They either failed to give information or given wrong information. And another very important impact or follow-up action by election commission is something that has been initiated in terms of prosecution of some of these people where they've given faulty information. So far, all these issues were not looked into. So now, because of the election watches that are being held, this is happening. And as I mentioned earlier, there is universal support by people, which is the best test of this all. We now come to certain other important issues which these election watches are trying to address: voter apathy, voter roll verification. You still have about, on an average, 20 to 30% of the voter rolls which are still faulty, either names omitted, names wrongly added, or age not being proper, names being spelt incorrectly, address not being proper. So this is again an ongoing process where civil society is engaging itself, and I think this is again of great importance. Monitoring polling booths, because you still have bogus voting. I don't know if all of you are familiar with it, where you might have a certain set of people who are supposed to vote, but then there's a group of people who just take over the polling booth and cast votes which are totally incorrect, illegal. You still have that happening. There have also been programs like Meet Your Candidate, common platforms, public debates, probably of the kind that one saw in the US recently. We come to the next slide, and this is again a very important statement made by the President of India. He said, cast your vote and be a proud contributor to the success of the largest democracy of all democracies. So these kind of appeals are being made in their personal capacity and in their official capacities by various organizations. We come to the last slide. In conclusion, I would like to say that basically this has been a remarkable achievement by civil society organizations which have come together, taken the initiative to actually have a PIL filed, public interest litigation. But then for all these things to really reach their logical end, you need a collaborative effort, and it has been historic that we've had election commissioners of the type of Mr. Lingdo and Mr. Krishnamurthy who've all come together as a part of this campaign to really try and reform the system in the way possible. And all these incremental changes, we're sure, will lead to improved governance and good governance, which again would reflect in improving the quality of life for all people. So with these points, I'll stop at this. Thank you for giving me a patient hearing.
Thank you very much, Jayanti, and for a really fascinating talk. I didn't know that all this was going on at all. And now I'm going to have the other big contemporary democracy issue, which is Ukraine, and we have Vadim, who's going to talk to us about the Ukrainian elections, and Natalia's going to translate. And maybe you should tell us a little bit about yourself.
Спасибо. Я прошу прощения за то, что буду говорить по-русски.
I apologize for talking in Russian.
Но проблема требует такого серьезного изложения и требует, соответственно,
But I really would like to explain everything in good detail to you.
И шекспировского же английского, поэтому я воспользуюсь помощью коллеги.
Is that all right? Can you hear me now?
Try this one. Is that one working?
It is working.
Yeah. You have that one. You can each have your own.
Сегодня утром в Таймсе я прочел одну фразу. И проникся чувством глубокой зависти к коллегам за столь точный образ, до которого не догадались мои соотечественники. То, что происходит сегодня на Украине, это нечто среднее между Вудстоком 69-го и Прагой 89-го.
they said what is happening in today's Ukraine is a sort of mixture between the Woodstock of 1960s and Eastern Europe of the 1990s.
С афористической точки зрения образ очень точный.
I think that's a very good comparison.
И его раскрытию, будем считать, я попробую посвятить ближайшие 10 минут своего сообщения.
And for the next 10 minutes, I'm going to explain why I like it so much.
Мифы и реальность в том, что происходит в Украине, перемешаны как цвета противоборствующих сторон.
Myth and reality. Reality have mixed in Ukraine as much as the colors of the opponent parties.
Они перепутали даже цветовую гамму главной украинской идеологии футбола.
They even mixed the color scheme of the main ideological myth in Ukraine, which is football.
Потому что Киев, поддерживающий Ющенко, выступает под оранжевыми цветами.
Kiev, which supports, Ющенко, plays under the orange color.
А оранжевый цвет, как известно, это цвета любимой команды Януковича, донецкого Шахтера.
And orange is the color of the favorite team of Yanukovych, which is Donetsk Shakhtar.
В свою очередь, Донецк выступает под бело-голубыми флагами.
Donetsk and Yanukovych use the blue colors.
White blue. А это, как известно, цвета знаменитого киевского Динамо.
And these are the colors of the famous Dynamo Kiev.
Но если серьезно, то революции вообще нужны цвета, аллюзии и, конечно же, аналогии.
Of course, every revolution needs its colors, its myths, and its comparisons.
Революцию в Киеве, конечно же, сравнивают с восточноевропейскими революциями начала 90-х.
The revolution in Kiev has been compared to the Eastern European revolutions of the 1990s.
И, конечно же, с грузинской, тем более, что украинская революция пришлась на первую годовщину свержения Шеварднадзе.
And of course it is compared to the Georgian revolution because it accidentally happened on the first anniversary of that revolution.
Эти аналогии и являются основополагающим мифом, мифом номер один, с которого и стоит начать, потому что все остальные вторичны.
And these analogies and these comparisons make up the first myth, the myth number one with which I want to start.
Это не бархатная революция восточного европейского или грузинского образца.
The revolution in Kiev is not the velvet revolution of Eastern Europe, and it's not the revolution of Georgia.
И как Украина находится между Вудстоком и Прагой,
and if Ukraine is between Woodstock and Prague,
так Грузия находится между Восточной Европой в этом смысле и нынешней Украиной.
Then Georgia is between Eastern Europe and today's Ukraine.
Грузия унаследовала часть признаков восточноевропейских и передала по наследству часть признаков Украины.
The Georgian Revolution had some features of the Eastern European Revolutions and did indeed import some features into the Ukrainian Revolution, but that's all.
В Восточной Европе и в Грузии революция свергала слабую, дряхлеющую власть, которая была уже не в состоянии сопротивляться.
Both in Eastern Europe and in Georgia, the revolutions were against the authority embodied by old and weak people who could not resist.
Однако есть большое принципиальное отличие.
And this marks a very big difference.
В Восточной Европе уходила эпоха и тоталитарная идеология.
The Eastern European revolutions put an end to the whole epoch and the totalitarian ideology.
В Грузии случилось совсем другое.
In Georgia, the situation was a bit different.
В Грузии, чем она интересна, впервые рухнула особая власть посттоталитарного типа.
The Georgian revolution was marked by the fact that it was the first revolution which toppled down a post-communist regime.
То, что теперь принято называть управляемой демократией.
Which is now called a managed democracy.
Про этот стиль власти можно писать целые университетские курсы.
And of course, I might guess that there are some university courses being run at the moment on that type of democracy.
И почему именно этот стиль утвердился на просторах постсоветского пространства, это тоже полсеместра, а мои 10 минут, к сожалению, уже истекают.
And of course, why this type of managed democracy was possible on the post-communist area is another very interesting question, which I cannot explore in my 10 minutes.
Отмечу лишь то, что непременным атрибутом и родовым признаком этого стиля власти является так называемая операция передачи власти.
I would only want to remark here that an essential part of that type of regime is an operation called the transition of power, or basically, transformation of power from one leader to another.
такая операция немыслима в условиях нормальной демократии.
And such a kind of transfer of power is impossible in a real democracy.
И точно так же без нее немыслима управляемая демократия.
But without the transfer of power, we cannot think of a managed democracy.
Можно поступить просто, как это происходит в Центральной Азии или в Беларуси, и просто перейти к пожизненному управлению.
Of course, some leaders could do what the Central European, Central Asian or the Belarusian presidents have done, simply to arrange to run for life.
Там же, где концентрация власти, по части концентрации власти таких успехов пока достичь не удается, приходится прибегать к некоторым хитростям.
But not all the leaders have managed to concentrate the power in such a great way, and therefore they have to use some cunning ways.
Например, искать удобного преемника, как, например, это произошло в России, где Путин сменил Ельцина.
Say to look for a very convenient successor, as, for example, happened in Russia, where Putin was chosen to take over from Yeltsin.
Секрет грузинской революции в том и состоит, что слабеющая, дряхлеющая власть была не в состоянии обеспечить такую
преемственность.
И контрольной точкой в таких ситуациях бывают как раз выборы. На выборах в Грузии власть рухнула так, что Саакашвили просто не успел от нее увернуться.
And of course, an essential sort of moment in the transfer of power is the elections. And what happened in Georgia is that the authorities simply tumbled down during the elections and literally fell into Saakashvili's hands.
В Украине же власть была также нелюбима, но очень сильна.
In Ukraine, the authorities were as much not liked, disliked by the society as in Georgia, but however, they were strong.
Украина вообще особый пример трансформации. Здесь стоит порассуждать о мотивах посткоммунистического успеха Балтии и Восточной Европы.
Ukraine, I think, presents a very specific case of transition, and I would like to very briefly return to the transitions and the reasons for success of the Eastern European transitions.
Будем считать необходимым лирическим отступлением, но это важно.
I think it's important.
Главный мотив этого успеха – это бегство.
I think the main reason why the Eastern European revolution succeeded is the social ability to run, to escape.
Замечательный литовский политолог Арвидас Юзайтис как-то по этому поводу заметил, что убегающий всегда в преимуществе, комментируя успех Литвы с точки зрения демократизации.
Famous political scientist Arvydas Juzauskas from Lithuania once said that to explain the success of Lithuanian transition is that the one who runs away, the one who starts to run first, always has an advantage.
Потому что именно всеобщей готовностью к спасению и бегству из-под коммунистического ига объясняются первые и самые главные импульсы восточноевропейских и балтийских экономических и политических реформ.
Because I think it was the society's readiness to run, which enabled them to run and to escape, which gave the consensus for taking those crucial, painful reforms of the early years of transition.
И именно этого импульса не хватило всем остальным постсоветским странам, от Азербайджана до Украины.
And all the other post-Soviet states did not have that impulse, that readiness to run. All the countries from Azerbaijan to Ukraine.
Украина, между прочим, крупнейшее государство Европы.
Ukraine, which accidentally is the biggest country in Europe.
Это вообще символ глубочайшего противоречия с этой точки зрения.
Has some very important contradictions.
Это противоречие значительно глубже расхожего тезиса о расколе Украины на Запад и Восток. К этому мифу мы еще вернемся, пока о другом. Украина совмещает в себе как восточноевропейскую готовность к бегству, так и российскую инерцию империи.
And also it has some imperial inertia, like Russia.
Потому что не надо забывать, что Украина была вторым ее краеугольным камнем.
Because we should not forget that Ukraine was the second keystone of the Soviet Empire after Russia.
У человека это считается раздвоением личности и считается болезнью.
If a person has it, it's considered to be, well, it's known as a multiple, as split identity disorder,
У государства это кончается глубочайшим кризисом, особенно когда силы каждого полушария раздвоенного мозга примерно равны. И наступает развязка в виде той самой революции. Кучма, так же, как и Шеварднадзе, вынужден был искать преемника. Но стиль управляемой демократии требует выстраивания бесчисленного количества балансов и компромиссов. Президент Кучма за 8 лет своего управления выстроил их столько, что уже никому не мог доверять эту преемственность. Цена вопроса высока. Безопасная и безбедная старость. Украина не пошла по пути операции «Преемник», такая, как произошла в России. Вопреки всеобщему убеждению, Виктор Янукович, премьер-министр, не является преемником в чистом виде. У него была другая функция. Он должен был, по затее Кучмы, временно перехватить власть, пока не вернется Кучма к этой же самой власти, но уже в виде премьер-министра после проведения политической реформы. Не получилось. И вовсе не потому, что Украина уже построила демократию или там созрело серьезное гражданское общество. Пока ни того, ни другого, к сожалению, в Украине не случилось. Просто украинцам не понравились три вещи.
Simply, like
первое, Кучма никогда никому не нравился. А Янукович обещал стать его продолжением, причем довольно-таки карикатурным. Но если бы Януковича выбрали честно или хотя бы сравнительно честно, да, украинцы бы это стерпели. Но поскольку для провозглашения Януковича президентом нужно было схитрить как минимум процентов на 12, и все это знали заранее. И оппозиция, и власть, и социологи. Это было общим местом. И власти пришлось ломать ситуацию через колено. И вот это украинцев уже обидело всерьез. И, наконец, третье, Россия.
Thirdly,
украинцы увидели, кого и как поддерживает Россия. И импульс к бегству, который был не использован в начале 90-х, пробудился снова. Это пока не гражданское общество. Как не было никакого гражданского общества в начале 90-х в Восточной Европе. Наличие общенационального, широкого, политически неоднородного и неструктурированного движения еще не является гражданским обществом. Каким бы протестным оно ни было. Это протоплазма для гражданского общества. Это народный фронт, а народный фронт создается не в строительстве демократии, а только для победы.
is created not to sustain a democracy. It's only created to introduce the democracy.
И было совершенно бессмысленно требовать от победившего Литовского Союза или Азербайджанского народного фронта или Украинского Руха, тоже достаточно успешного, немедленного утверждения либеральных принципов.
And also it was quite naive to expect from the victorious Lithuanian Azerbaijani and quite successful Ukrainian Popular Front to build a real liberal democracy.
Там, где повезло, в той же самой Балтии, Восточной Европе, из этой протоплазмы начала выстраиваться политическая структура.
In Lithuania, they got lucky, and out of this proto-front, they created a democratic political structure.
Где не повезло, реформы захлебнулись.
And those countries which were not that lucky, well, they saw the reforms and get stalled.
Ющенко, конечно же, ближе к своим восточноевропейским удачливым коллегам, к Гавелу, к Валенсии и так далее.
Of course, Ющенко shares a lot of resemblances with his Eastern European colleagues, such as Havel and Valesa.
Но здесь мы переходим к еще одному очень важному принципиальному нюансу нынешних событий в Украине, которые очень важны для понимания того, что происходит на посттоталитарном пространстве вообще.
But this leads us to another point, which is essential for understanding the processes on the post-totalitarian area.
Бюрократическую чиновную власть, которая утвердилась на этих просторах, может победить только тот, кто сам ею являлся.
In the post-Soviet area, the authorities are now the power belongs to the bureaucrats, and if you want to topple that bureaucratic power down, you have to be one of the bureaucrats as well.
Романтические времена Гавела и Валенсы прошли. Саакашвили, любимый ученик Шеварднадзе и министр юстиции. Ющенко давно часть украинской элиты и бывший премьер-министр. Наступают совсем другие времена, революционерам противостоят не дряхлые старики, а крепкие волки.
The times have changed, and now the revolutionaries who want democracy have to face not old people, but very strong wolves.
Их бархатными ручками не сломаешь.
And they cannot take them with velvet gloves.
Поэтому нужно быть хотя бы немного одним из них.
You have to be one of them.
Но именно этим буржуазные революции лучше пролетарских.
But I think this is what makes bourgeoisie revolutions better than proletarian.
Свои по крови всегда смогут договориться о балансах, о компромиссах.
Because people who share the same circles, the same understandings, can always strike a deal or a compromise.
Сарказм истории заключается не только в том, что власть в Украине защищает такой человек, как Янукович.
The irony is not only that the person who defends power or the regime in Ukraine is somebody like Yanukovych.
Человек с двумя судимостями.
The person who actually has been imprisoned twice.
История издевается еще и тем, что ему противостоит и идеалы демократии защищает такой человек, как Ющенко.
Finally, again, ironically enough, his opponent, the person who defends the ideals of democracy, Ющенко,
политик западного типа,
is a politician of the Western type,
но довольно слабый, не харизматичный.
But he's weak and he's not charismatic.
И ощущающий свою связь с прежней элитой.
And who is linked to the previous Soviet elite?
Так что мы можем сказать, что в тех местах, где лимит революции еще не исчерпан,
therefore we can say that in certain countries where the limit, the potential for revolution is not exhausted yet,
то, что раньше называлось буржуазной революцией, теперь будет называться бюрократической.
What used to be called bourgeoisie revolutions will now be called bureaucratic revolutions.
И Украина, может быть, я надеюсь, что сможет стать доказательством того, что все-таки буржуазные революции делали мир лучше. И последний миф. Очень многие, наблюдая за Украиной, уже начинают загибать пальцы, подсчитывая, кто следующий.
Many observers who keep an eye on the Ukrainian Ukrainian revolution try to figure out who will be the next.
Список кандидатов следующих был обнародован уже в день объявления Януковича президентом.
The day Yanukovych was proclaimed the president, a list of his possible successors appeared.
Каждый из этих кандидатов счел необходимым поздравить Януковича.
And each of those possible successors decided it was important to congratulate you in college.
И список был довольно выразителен.
The list was quite impressive.
Кроме Путина, это был Лукашенко.
Apart from Putin, that was Lukashenko,
президент Белоруссии,
the president of Belarus,
президент Армении Кочарян,
the president of Armenia Kocharyan,
президент Узбекистана Каримов,
the president of Uzbekistan Karimov,
и президент Киргизии Акаев.
And the president of Kyrgyzia Akayev.
Странным образом в этот список не попал президент Казахстана Назарбаев.
Strangely, president of Kazakhstan Nazarbayev was not among them.
В окружении президента Алиева улыбаются и говорят, что наш президент чему-чему, но научился ждать.
The president of Azerbaijan did not congratulate either, and his aides said, well, that at least our president knows how to wait.
Однако, как-то не неприятно, но надо предостеречь от излишних иллюзий и ожиданий. Ожидания излишние.
Unfortunately, we have to say that we should not be too hopeful, not feel victorious.
Дело в том, что Украина все-таки на постсоветском фоне была одним из самых демократичных государств.
Among the post-Soviet states, Ukraine used to be one of the most democratic ones.
Демократичных в том смысле, что власть все-таки не была полностью монополизирована.
It was democratic in the sense that the authority was not fully consolidated and monopolized.
Это недостаточное условие для нормальной демократии, но, по крайней мере, необходимое.
It's not sufficient for full democracy, but at least it's an essential condition for normal democracy.
Точно так же было в Грузии.
Actually, the situation was the same in Georgia as well.
К сожалению, Грузии и Украиной список стран, где власть еще не монополизирована, пока ограничен.
Unfortunately, Georgia and Ukraine still are the only two countries on the list of post-Soviet states in which the power is not fully monopolized yet.
Поэтому живущий в Лондоне Борис Абрамович Березовский полон оптимизма и говорит, что судьба России решается в Украине.
That's why the Boris Berezovsky, who lives now, who resides in London, keeps saying that the fate of Russia is being decided in Ukraine at the moment.
Боюсь, что нет.
I'm afraid not.
И это самое печальное для России.
I'm afraid he's wrong, and this is very bad for Russia.
Потому что нынешняя российская власть уже выигрывает того, что происходит в Украине.
Because I think the current Russian authorities, the current Russian government have already benefited of what is going on in Ukraine.
Та самая инерция империи,
inertia,
на которую поставил нынешний российский режим,
hoped,
он является залогом реванша и того консервативного устройства, которое не позволяет России правильно оценить то, что происходит в Украине. Режиму удалось убедить, что стабильность важнее любых изменений, даже таких, как Украина. Так что, если Украина уже входит в Вудстокско-Пражское пространство, то Россия по-прежнему отделена от него западной границей.
So separated from it by its western border.
С чем остаюсь поздравить Украину.
And we only have to be happy for Ukraine.
Спасибо.
Thank you very much for another fascinating description of democratic revolutions going on. And finally, I'm very happy that we've got Hilary Wainwright, the editor of Red Pepper, who's been working with us on these issues and is, I don't know what she's going to say.
Well, Mary, thanks. And also, it's been really interesting. I've learned a lot from listening to Vadim and Jayanta. So that's influenced my talk a little. And thanks also for allowing me to participate, not just in this meeting, but also in writing for the Civil Society Yearbook, which I really recommend to everybody. If you haven't bought it, I don't know if it's on special offer, but probably, anyhow, it's worth buying. And actually, the process of doing it sort of took me on a global trip, at least in terms of books, not actually, unfortunately, going to China and Guatemala and various places that I wrote about. I'm not quite sure how what I'm going to say fits in with Vadim's, in praise of bourgeois revolutions. I think what I'm going to say is really about revolutions that build on the gains of liberal democracy, the gains of bourgeois revolutions, but go beyond them. I think we're in a situation where the importance of the ballot is being constantly asserted, you know, both in the Ukraine, in India, and in the United States. The fact, you know, that as Mary was saying, people who previously didn't vote were voting this time. You know, the people we were agreeing with, obviously, and were observing particularly, were those that were, however much they disagreed with Kerry, just were determined to get Bush out. And so you had a kind of movement. I mean, Mary, or in the blurb for this, refers to the League of Pissed Off Voters. You had a whole lot of people who previously had been active, but just leaving the issue of the ballot box to people who they felt weren't going to bring about change, but decided that their movement for change, which was particularly the peace movement, the anti-war movement, needed an electoral victory. I won't sort of dwell on the lessons from the US, but we can come back to that. But at the same time as that sort of assertion of the importance of the ballot, there's also all around us an assertion of the inadequacy of the ballot, the insufficiency of electoral democracy as a means of democracy. Not that it's unnecessary, not that it can be in any way sort of got rid of, but it needs reinforcement. It needs a deeper form of democracy. And I suppose that's what I really want to talk about fairly briefly, because we want to have a participatory discussion. And I want to really talk about participatory democracy as a form of counter-power for democracy that reinforces the power of the vote in the face of both bureaucratic power, corporate power. I mean, the fact that in India, you know, almost the day after the election, the stock markets virtually collapsed. And that led to quite a significant shift in the direction of the government that people had just elected for, had elected. Well, that's not democracy. There needs to be, and there are the sort of bases of, forms of democratic power that can in some way resist that sort of subtle threat to democracy. I've just come back from Latin America, where, in a sense, that combination between the kind of importance and belief in the ballot box and the search for deeper forms of democracy is particularly acute, because in a way the radicals, the people concerned with addressing the social injustice and inequality, which is an extreme, no more extreme than in India, but you know, in a particularly extreme form in Latin America, they were shaped by fighting dictatorships, US-backed dictatorships in most of the countries, well, certainly that I visited in Argentina, in Brazil, in Uruguay. And so, you know, have a really deep moral belief in the gains of the bourgeois revolutions, in a way, and the gains of liberal democracy and the franchise in particular. They went through hell to achieve that. I mean, literally, the guy that I interviewed in Uruguay, who's now one of the most popular senators, got the most votes in the election of the Frente Amplio, the new sort of left coalition that's won office in Uruguay. He'd been a leader of the Tupamaros, the guerrillas fighting the dictatorship, and had been tortured in the most, you know, ghastly way, sort of had his head sort of, you know, thrust into sort of shit and urine. And I was interviewing him on the day that his head was on the front page of the newspapers. And, you know, for him, winning that vote and the electoral success was incredibly important. He'd been a friend of Supercomandante Marcos, who'd come over to Uruguay to train with the Tupamaros. So I said, well, just imagine if Supercomandante was here and, you know, sitting in this room in the parliament, what would be your conversation? What would he think of you sitting here? And this guy, Jose Mujica, said, it doesn't matter where you sit, it's what you do from where you sit. And he said, I'm very fat, and I would look, it would be a joke if I went around in a mask. But, you know, he was just saying that what he was doing in parliament was as important in Uruguay as what Supercomandante Marcos was doing through his particular kind of guerrilla army. I mean, I said to him also, how will things be, you know, in a few years' time, you know, after this government has tried to bring about the changes it's been committed to? And he said, it'll be a mess. You know, there'll be demonstrations outside, and, you know, we'll be facing real problems. But he still said, you know, I said, well, what will make sure that you're not with the demonstrators, that you're here? And he described the kind of program of basic reforms that he felt could be achieved through Parliament, but not only through Parliament. So he then talked about the participatory forms of democracy that he and the Fronte Ampulo were trying to encourage, building on experiences in municipal government in Montevideo. And I wanted really to particularly talk about the country where, in a sense, perhaps the most exemplary models of participatory democracy have been developed, in Brazil, and the kind of paradoxes of the situation there and the kind of lessons and issues that that poses, just to throw into the sort of mix of geographical comparisons that we can draw on, or that you'll draw on in the discussion. Because I think in Brazil, too, you know, you had this, as part of this Latin American phenomenon of this combination of a passionate belief in liberal democracy with the invention of deeper forms of participatory democracy. You know, you have the Workers' Party, which is the product of that combination, you know, a party that fought the dictatorship and as a result, you know, believed and fought in elections with a real sort of imaginative passion. But at the same time, in a sense, maybe having, you know, all these political coalitions and parties having faced dictatorships that came after electoral. I mean, they weren't coming out of a sort of non-electoral, non-bourgeois situation. Most of them were the product of very frail democracies. So they have in their memories the sort of weakness of a purely electoral system. But more than that, they have in the kind of movements that were developed to resist the dictatorship, particularly in Brazil, a kind of experience of mass democratic movements that invented forms of participatory democracy. You know, when I talk to people in Porto Alegre, which is the city that perhaps is most famous for its participatory democracy, you know, where did some of these ideas come from? And they would talk about the radical trade union movement, the CUCI. You know, how, I mean, that was an unofficial trade union movement that began from the factories around São Paulo and from the sort of base upwards. And the way they sort of allocated their money, the money of the union, the branch, the membership fees and so on, was every branch would discuss the priorities that they wanted, and then a process of sort of delegation upwards would determine the overall budget of the union, and that kind of influenced the thinking about the participatory budget in Porto Alegre. And I think one of the things in writing my yearbook, I was sort of thinking about the wider implications of the Porto Alegre experience. And I think one of the important things about it is that it presents a model, I mean, not one that we should just simply imitate, but one from which principles can be drawn, of a form of participatory democracy which is highly structured, which provides real mechanisms for deliberation, provides a basis for a rule-governed process of participation, which is constantly under negotiation, constantly under self-criticism. And in a sense, certainly challenges those of us that were using the slogans of participatory democracy in the late 60s, when we tended to treat it in a rather romantic way as a kind of spontaneous development. I mean, there was Paris 68, which was, I mean, I'm sure it was very well organized in lots of ways, but it had that air of sort of spontaneity. So participatory democracy in that sort of early period had this kind of unstructured notion. I mean, there was beginnings of a critique of it then. The women's movement, which was a form of participatory democracy, produced a very influential pamphlet called The Tyranny of Structurelessness, but never really arrived at very sort of developed structures. In Porto Alegre, because the whole idea of participatory democracy arose in order to determine the budget, you know, the party came into office governed by these principles that getting into office is only half the battle, then there needs to be the development of a stronger kind of power. And in a very ad hoc way, faced with the financial problems of the city, said, well, we'll turn to the movements that brought us to power and discuss with them, share with them the problems. And out of that, after a process of 15 years of trial and error, came a very developed cross-city sort of process of participatory discussion and negotiation. And I stress the cross-city because I think one thing that's particularly important about it is it's sort of citizen-based rather than particularistic. You know, it's not like one community versus other communities or one section of the unions versus others, but there's a constant effort to develop a sort of citywide picture. And I think, you know, what we can see there is a development of popular democracy, which is not only a contrast to the sort of romanticism of the 60s, which also imagined that this sort of participatory process could somehow surpass the sort of decaying character of Parliament, as distinct from sort of invigorate it and put pressure on it. But it's also a contrast to the sort of populism that Mary referred to at the beginning, that you see in Bush's use of civil society. And so I think it's a kind of important model for thinking about, you know, what I think will become a more and more important issue in the light of the US experience. You know, what does it mean to develop and campaign for and work for democratic civil society? We can't just sort of evoke civil society in itself. I mean, the other kind of distinctive feature of the participatory democracy developed now in many cities in Brazil, not just Porto Alegre, but São Paulo, the third biggest city in the world, they developed a really imaginative attempt at participatory democracy, including involving children and transvestites and every single social group in ways that, you know, we could discuss in more detail later. But I think that part of it was about trying to get at that sort of gulf between the election of a politician and then the process of implementation, sort of between sort of cup and lip, as it were, between election and implementation. That's where you see in Porto Alegre, it was all the sort of corruption that's rampant in, or has been rampant in Latin America. We can see it, you know, here in terms of the lobbies and vested interests, which sort of almost, you know, occupy departments like the department dealing with waste. I've sort of been talking to colleagues recently, you know, who describe the way in which all the sort of big waste companies are completely sort of embedded in these departments. Similarly, you know, the armed companies in the Department of Industry and the Department of Defense. And in a sense, what participatory democracy did was to sort of open up those departments. I mean, it was something there was a very brief experience of here in Britain in the early 70s, and it was treated, you know, with shock and horror that Tony Benn should say, well, let's go and talk to the shop stewards in Lucas Aerospace or the different sort of defense companies. Now, I mean, what I wanted to briefly just go on to, because I must finish pretty soon, is what happened when that idea, that sort of thinking about participatory democracy, helped to lead to the election of the PT to government, to the election of Lula to the presidency of Brazil, which was an incredible achievement, you know, after three or four times failing, a kind of movement developed. Well, and also various kinds of political alliances, which in a way have proved part of the problem now. And we now have a situation where Lula came to office with an election mandate of around about 60%, you know, from huge expectations that this would lead to addressing the massive inequalities in Brazil. And his rhetoric was very much one of, I can't do it myself, you know, you must trust me, but I need to trust you, I need to work with you. And he said that not only to the people of Brazil, but to the kind of international movement at the World Social Forum. And so there was sort of real hope that we'd see the principles of participatory democracy, you know, worked on, extended, developed to a national level, and then thinking through what that would mean internationally. And there were many opportunities. I'm not implying that it's in any way sort of easy or that anybody's got a real answer, but, you know, there were very many innovative sort of ideas developing in Brazil, like the Minister for Cities, was somebody who had been a mayor of Porto Alegre and a governor of the region of Rio Grande do Sul, which had itself tried to develop a participatory budget. Olivio Dutra is his name, and he tried to develop the idea that his budget would be discussed in all the major cities of Brazil. The landless movement, too, the minister at the Ministry of Agriculture worked with the landless movement on a sort of plan for taking over the land. One of the big priorities was dealing with hunger, just the fact that people didn't have a square meal a day. And there was the Zero Hunger Program, which, again, could have been implemented through all sorts of participatory processes at a local level. But in fact, very little has changed. In fact, you know, reading recently about the landless situation, actually, Cardoso, the previous president, got more landless people onto the land than Lula. Unemployment is still round about officially 10%, in reality probably about 16%. There's really deep disillusion. The PT have lost Porto Alegre, they've lost São Paulo in the recent elections, partly as a result of this disillusion. And the disillusion is a result, you know, as probably all of you know, of the incredible pressures that the IMF put on Lula, firstly forcing him to agree to repay the debt, a debt which was incurred under the dictatorship and under previous governments that Lula had no sort of direct responsibility for. And that whole sort of financial pressure of not just the IMF but the financial markets, which would have forced a financial crisis as soon as Lula got into government. So there was no easy answer. I mean, I hate even describing it because it's so depressing in a way, and it's also something that you can't sit kind of in an armchair or a desk in London sort of implying that you know the answer. But talking to people there just, you know, 2-3 weeks ago, there were lots of people with very concrete plans, with very strong possibilities. But in the end, that's not where Lula looked to. He looked to people who would sort of satisfy the expectations and pressures of the business community, and appointed economic ministers who hadn't got the sort of imagination to apply participatory democracy, which after all had won a lot of support amongst the middle classes of places like Porto Alegre. It wasn't, you know, it was a kind of idea which was about improving the quality of life in the city, achieving a sort of redistribution which would also be something that most of the middle classes of that city were satisfied to see. So, you know, we've got a situation there which, you know, is very problematic, is leading people to think, you know, can the PT be transformed? Why has this happened? And I think, the kind of strategy which could have been adopted is one that shows the possibility of, and hopefully it's maybe something that will develop in Uruguay. And obviously Venezuela is a more complicated situation, and there's the sort of dangers of populism there, but also the emergence of more structured kinds of democracy. But, I mean, what could have happened was the development of participatory democracy as a real counterpart. So when the IMF pressured, Lula, in a sense, had another pressure on him and would have to say, well, hang on to the IMF. Look, you know, I'm going to get riots on the street. I'm going to get riots in the factories. I'm going to get strikes. There's a movement that I've got to be able to satisfy. We've got to negotiate. In a sense, he would have been generating a counter-pressure on him and on the party that could have been a counter to the IMF, and also could have elicited action and support and pressure, you know, by people in Britain, people in the United States. I mean, Gordon Brown has considerable clout on the IMF. If there was sort of a real movement in Brazil that we were feeling a visible, sort of vivid connection with, I think there could be real pressure here. So I think the sort of notion of counterpies, democratic counterpies, the one I want to leave with you, I think it also leads to trying to rethink the political party, the whole nature of a political party. I mean, it's interesting that the civil society movements in the United States this time are not saying, let's create a new party. I mean, it's something that was thought about sort of 15 years ago. But now people are sort of exploring what kinds of political representation can give expression to forms of action and forms of power outside the electoral sphere. In a sense, that thinking is based on a recognition that the state doesn't have a monopoly of being an instrument for social change, that the power of people in the community, in the factories, culturally and so on, can be just as important. And what kind of parties can be reinvented to enable that kind of power to be expressed? I mean, in a sense, parties historically, like the Labour Party, have come out of civil society. I mean, the Labour Party came out of the trade union movement. But in a sense, civil society then handed over to the political party. And the political party, in turn, treated the movements from which they came not as sort of active, knowing agents of social change, but as supporters, sources of votes, sources of money. So I think we've got to think both of new forms of democracy in relation to controlling and monitoring and making accountable the state, but also new forms of democracy in terms of the kind of political parties that can really value citizens and activists as sources of change of the kind that we've seen both in India and in Ukraine.
Well, thanks. This was supposed to be a public debate, but all our speakers spoke much longer than they were asked to, but they were all so interesting that I let them talk, and also I'm a very bad chairperson. But we have very few minutes left to ask some questions, so anybody who would like to ask a question, please do.
Yeah, I have a short question. Actually to all panel members. The way I understood the presentations is that, or what struck me in them, is that most of these changes came from a popular movement at home or some sort of civil society. And second is that none of the countries really form a threat to say, Europe, for instance, or to other states. And my question is, what do you do in case society does form a real threat, and there is no real civil society to build on, or very little. What would you suggest can be done to support such incipient civil society?
Well, before I ask anybody to answer, I'm going to take a few more questions. The gentleman in the back there.
Yeah, just. In comparison, I think it's for the whole panel, in terms of comparing the three dimensions of the topic. And it was interesting to see that India, with all its 8 million ballot stations and 668 million voters, but yet it isn't on the United Nations Security Council and the General Assembly in terms of its status as a democracy when compared to the Western construct of Western Europe and North America. So what did the panel think of that kind of comparison in terms of global governance?
Nice.
I have a question in particular for Vadim, because I was somewhat surprised, having, like all of us, of course, seen people standing in the freezing cold for 2 weeks, to hear a somewhat sceptical, perhaps even cynical presentation or a kind of appraisal of what we have seen. And although I think you may be very right of saying this is ephemeral, this is a popular front, this may not go anywhere, nonetheless, I wonder, when you hear the other two presentations, India, this kind of long-term civil society initiative of really calling politicians to account, and for Brazil, the participatory budgeting ideas, do you think this is where Ukrainian civil society might be in 10, 15, 20 years, or is it a different universe?
Anyway, the
gentleman. In the tussle between the breakaway from the past system and the shadow of the imperial inertia, why the imperial inertia did not cast its long shadow? So why it was not the cracking down on the protesting masses, and why we didn't see the worst case scenario? What prevented that?
Okay, I'm going to take some answers now, and then we'll come back to you two. I think Vadim has to talk first, because he had more questions.
Теоретически есть опасность того, что произойдет революция без гражданского, произойдет революция толпы в стране, где нет гражданского общества. Но пока в тех странах, где нет гражданского общества, его потому и нет, что там существует более или менее тоталитарный режим.
But I think the reason there is no civil society in the countries under consideration is because there is quite a strong totalitarian regime.
Поэтому на этом пространстве возможны только революции того или иного антитоталитарного толка.
Therefore, which this means that the only revolution possible in these circumstances is an anti-totalitarian revolution rather than any other.
На мой взгляд, лучший пример это Иран.
I think Iran is Iraq.
Иран.
Иран furnishes the best sort of example.
Как согласны даже американцы, многие американцы, в частности Бжезинский.
As some American analysts agree, including Бжезинский.
Иран имеет самые хорошие демократические перспективы из всех стран этого региона.
Iran has the best democratic perspectives or the best democratic potential out of all the countries in the region.
Другое дело, что мало кто решится ждать, когда эти перспективы реализуются.
Of course, nobody wants to wait until that potential is realized.
Но для того, чтобы случилось то, о чем вы говорите,
but what I mean, or for to happen for what you suggest might happen,
чтобы случились изменения от лучшего к худшему,
to have a transition from sort of better things to worse things.
Пусть сначала произойдет изменение от худшего к лучшему.
We have to first go from worse things to better things.
Это касается всех стран, о которых мы говорим.
And I think that's sort of relevant to all post-Soviet countries.
Что касается упрека в аморальности.
As for cynicism and amorality.
Понимаете, это очень большая драма, на
you
самом деле.
What's going on is a huge drama.
С одной стороны, я завидую украинцам.
I have to say I envy Ukrainians. I'm jealous.
Потому что, действительно, слава богу, что в этой стране нашлось достаточное количество людей, которые вышли возмутиться тем, как обошлись с их выбором.
Because, well, thank God there was enough people, enough individuals in that country who could not take the abuse or could not take how their vote was treated.
Это настоящий и многообещающий порыв.
And this is a very promising effort.
Этот порыв смел диктатуры в Восточной Европе в начале 90-х. Сейчас происходит, это происходит, но происходит и другое.
And of course this takes place as well. It is taking place, but parallel to that there's another process.
В чем и состоит принципиальное отличие того, что происходило в Восточной Европе, от того, что происходит сейчас в Украине. И происходило в 91-м году, кстати говоря, в России. Очень много очень честных, очень хороших, очень романтичных, идеалистичных людей, которые верят в демократию.
A lot of people who are very honest, good, naive, and who romantic and who really believe in democracy.
Они становятся не самостоятельной силой, как это было в Восточной Европе в начале 90-х, а используются как инструмент в политической борьбе. Это не я циничен. Это жизнь так цинично устроена. И это, наверное, часть ответа на третий вопрос. Почему не надавили имперские силы? А потому они надавили, что инструмент казался очень эффективным.
Well,
спасибо.
Now, do either of you want to say something?
The Security Council, it's...
Couldn't agree more with you on that.
I mean, I could say something. The first question was a little bit enigmatic, but I mean, were you talking about a country like Iraq?
There are many countries which can see as posing a threat. I think Iran is a threat.
Sorry. I mean, I don't know enough about it. Iran, but I mean, just taking Iraq, because I, you know, was thinking about that. I mean, even before the war, about this issue of a country where, you know, apparently the civil society isn't very strong, and actually then talking to Iraqis in exile, and they were describing to me, you know, the sort of actually the kind of organisation of civil society beneath the surface. I mean, forms of organisation that weren't sort of political or weren't overt, but you know, were and has now have now come to be shown to be the basis of well, what's now been pretty much sort of, well, so polarised by military action. But I mean, there was a period when you did see, and Mary knows more about it than me, but you know, the beginnings and emerging of a more overt organised civil society, and you know, a lot of its roots lay within sort of cultural forms. And I was in New Zealand, not New Zealand, Taiwan, which was, you know, well, it's long emerged from a dictatorship, but talking to them about how a movement against the dictatorship that Chiang Kai-shek sort of emerged. And again, you know, they could trace it back to the emergence of a sort of kind of literary dissent, poetry, art. I mean, same in Eastern Europe. So I think I always, when people say, you know, there's not any civil society or it's, you know, it's not strong, I just want to first actually find out a bit what form resistance of a less political form is taking, and then think how that can be supported and strengthened, both in terms of challenging Western support for, or other support for that dictatorship, but then also more direct kind of support to the incipient sort of movements that exist.
Okay, I'm going to take these two here.
I've got a question for Hilary Wainwright about Latin America. I read, I think recently, they have a conference which was something which would be very good for the region, that they were thinking of unifying the whole country. I've forgotten which country it was in. I don't know if you know anything about it. A greater unity than ever before in the history of Latin America, and Brazil, which is important, will be part of this. I don't know whether this has come to your attention, if you have any comment on it.
My question is specific. What percentage of people vote in India? In America, less than 60% of the voters voted in the recent presidential election. And it's much the same in all the elections here in Europe. So voter apathy means that, in fact, today our governments are not representative.
Yeah.
We have election-wise turnout. For the last election that was held, the parliamentary election, it was in the range of about 55%, the turnout. But the maximum that we had, the lowest that we had so far, was in the year 1971. It was perhaps the lowest, and after that it has increased. But the current year has not been the highest, but it has been more or less in that range. It hovers around 57 to 60. That is the range that it is in normally. I mean, so there is voter apathy, and again, here it is the educated people, perhaps, who do not really go out and vote. If you look at, there is an urban-rural divide. You find rural people perhaps voting more, and again, poorer sections, and that perhaps also explains the results of the elections that just happened, because there was this campaign of India shining, feel good, and so on, which was perceived by the common people as something that didn't happen to them. It was perceived as if they were alienated. And this is something that only touched the lives of the richer people. So,
the question about Latin America, I think you're meaning, you're talking about Mercosur, the regional alliance that brings together, or at least, you know, Lula and others are trying to strengthen it, to bring together the different, particularly sort of South Latin American countries. I mean, yeah, no, I think that's really important. I think that is a part of Lula's strategy, which is trying to develop a counterpower. I mean, their foreign policy is very shrewd, I think. I mean, it is trying to build a sort of economic independence from the US and a means of challenging US economic power. I mean, both in terms of within Latin America, but then also I think we saw it in the recent WTO meeting where Brazil worked with India and China and did actually effectively challenge, well, the US and Europe. So I think in terms of their foreign policy, they actually do have a very sophisticated, rather long-term but important way of challenging US power.
Well, I think we have come to a close, and I want to thank everybody very much. I just wanted to say one thing about this very fascinating emerging relationship between civil society and the ballot box and the different models that we've seen. And that's really in response to our first question about can civil society be a threat? Because I've just come back from a meeting on democracy in the Middle East. And this was a meeting of Democrats, people who were opposed to authoritarianism, who wanted political reform. But there was a huge divide among them. And the divide was how to deal with Islam. Everybody was more or less of an agreement that if you had real democracy in the Middle East, you had open, free elections, Islamist movements would come to power. And some people felt that Islamist movements are so anti-women, anti-homosexuals, or other kinds of restrictions, that you shouldn't allow democracy because these kinds of people would come to power. Whereas others felt, actually, the only way to deal with these extremist Islamic movements is engaging them in a public debate. And I do think, I happen to agree with the second viewpoint. And I do think actually that's the essence of what civil society is all about. I mean, if you go back to the original meaning of civil society, it was all about an arena where people debate and discuss their differences rather than, as was done in the past, depending on fear, prejudice to rule. That's what it was all about. And I think these extremist attitudes do arise in a situation where it's possible to mobilize on the basis of fear and prejudice. And that's what Hillary was referring to, a conversation we had this morning when I was saying, is what Bush did civil society, or was Bush mobilizing on the basis of fear and prejudice and superstition? And opening up society to debate and participation is a way, it seems to me, of confronting that. Now, I realize that's a very utopian, modernist, enlightenment optimism. But I think this is something we do have to believe in if we believe in civil society and democracy. So thank you, everybody, for coming. And I look forward to seeing you at another. And do buy a copy of our book.